This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step 3 is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on community radio at 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette.
The United Nations Climate Conference this year will be in Belém, COP30. I went to Belém many years ago. It's at the mouth of the Amazon, and the river is so wide there that you cannot see the other side. I remember we stayed in a small riverside pension on the first night, and the room had no beds. There were hooks on the walls and a hook on the ceiling for mozzie nets, but in order to sleep that night, we needed to go down into the market to buy hammocks. I remember men, shiny with sweat, running along the piers with gigantic Amazon fish on their heads. The feeling of abundance was overwhelming, and at night, the sound of thousands of birds coming down to roost in the mangroves was deafening. This year, the thousands arriving by air will be climate delegates from all corners of the world. At this climate conference, so many countries will be speaking of floods and landslides, sickening droughts, followed by bushfires. And what used to be called acts of God when I was a child are now dimly perceived as events made much worse by humans. I think we only dimly understand it, but it's starting to appear that we have to do something about it and can. The feeling of abundance in nature is faltering as we hastily create great koala parks and marine reserves to give it a chance. And the feeling of agency is also faltering as trust in government, including international government, is undermined. But we are not here to falter. We are here to work out how to be prepared. And I attended the DisasterWise Community Conference in September, Community Congress, actually. A common theme was, we must not wait for someone to rescue us. Building up our communities is key, and the time is now. I've invited one of the speakers, Dr. Jean Renouf, to speak to us. He's been an international aid worker, a firefighter, and founder of a group called Plan C. Welcome, Jean. First, tell us what it's like where you are.
Great. Thank you very much for the opportunity today. So, of the Bundjalung Nation in Lismore, northern New South Wales.
And are you having good weather at the moment? No floods on the horizon?
No floods. It's been very hot and dry to the point that I've heard yesterday a new expression. You may have heard of the concept of flash flooding, when suddenly, you know, there's so much amount of water going down fast through a valley that destroys everything on its way. Well, yesterday I heard of a new concept called flash droughts. The land here was green and lush, giving all the amount of rain we have had for the past few years. And suddenly, in a space of a few weeks, really, it's becoming all brown.
Well, you told the Congress, my life was about disaster. So tell us about that.
I moved to Australia in 2014. I'm French from original background. I'm now Australian. My two boys are born in Australia, and Australia is my home. But prior to moving to Australia, I worked as an international aid worker and researcher, especially focused on countries undergoing all sorts of crises and challenges. So I spent several years working in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Congo and the Central African Republic and Gaza and Palestine and Yemen and also a number of countries like Haiti and Bolivia in Americas, in the Central and South America. So for 15 years of my life, really, either as an aid worker or as a researcher, I was kind of living in countries where disruption was a norm. Mm. So that's I mean, my life. I've been in place of privilege and extremely lucky to be able to make the choices I have made. So my life was not a disaster, but certainly underpinned by disastrous contexts.
But I imagine that travels with you. You'll never forget that. Those people will be still with you, those people for whom it's the norm, who just are resilient.
That's right. The people, the stories, the changes also, or sometimes the lack of changes, all of are extraordinary learnings. And in a way, kind of thanks to these learnings, when I moved to Australia back in 2014, based on that past experience and also as a researcher, my understanding of climate science and where we were heading, the projections from climate scientists, I had a sense that Australia was also going to go through a number of large-scale compounding disruptive disasters. And we were clearly not only not prepared for this, but also not even aware of that reality, really, as a society, as a nation. We were still the lucky country, still, eagerly celebrating summer and everything comes with it, the beach, the outdoor experience, barbecues, the Australia Day, everything. But, of course, across the country, we've experienced massive, unprecedented disasters. And the Black Summer of 2019, 2020. And I think our kind of collective sense of and perception of the summer, but also weather and our relation with nature has shifted forever. I think for now, as a nation, especially in a weather like this one today, a number of people across the country will be wondering, kind of getting nervous. I can smell some smoke in the air with this sort of kind of traumatic response. So certainly it's been a steep learning curve, I think, for us as a nation, and we are scrambling, as you rightly said before, but at least heading in the right direction to adapt and make the changes that are needed.
Yes.
And even subtropical rainforests that don't usually burn were actually on fire.
We have the obligation to care for country.
So much forest burnt that around 3 billion animals are either killed or displaced.
The more we push back against the colonial apparatus, the more positive change we can have in terms of addressing climate change.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.
I think you've been in places, you say many places, these terrible crisis points. Often it's caused by war, but often it is a climate change push factor behind those scenes that we see in the
Correct.
news all the time. And people find that plan A, the business as usual that they'd expected to work throughout their lives, doesn't work anymore. Plan B, which is slightly better, is not sufficient. And they are unprepared. So how do you at Plan C help them prepare in that liminal space? You said that at the conference, something about the liminal space when they realize, gosh, you've got to do something new, something creative.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, Plan C is a non-for-profit registered charity, which I founded in 2019, precisely in anticipation of those large-scale compounding disasters. So, of course, I did not foresee the actual Black Summer or the 2022 flood that devastated our Northern Rivers region, but I did see that such disasters were inevitably going to come and disrupt our ways of living and that our services were not ready. I'm a firefighter. I've been a firefighter for 10 years now, and I could see the emergency services, did not grasp the scale of what was coming. And the systems that relied on functioning roads and communications and structures, were not ready for that. And case in point, a number of fire stations, police stations, SES stations were flooded, which is incredibly poor planning, if you think of it.
Yeah.
So Plan C, the mission of Plan C is to build the resilience and regenerative capacities of Australian communities, to help them essentially connect with each other, build practical skills that allow them to navigate the disruptions and continue functioning, but also make sense and find solace in knowing what to do, how to do it, and doing it with others. So the C stands for community. Our plan is the community. So As Value, we work collaboratively with, governments, with institutions, with the establishments, emergency services, and the likes. But we do not wait for them. We kind of, do what we have to do as best as we can as members of the community. Now, that liminal space that you mentioned, it comes from every month for 9 months, we invite different speakers, climate scientists, indigenous leaders, philosophers, eco-psychologists, permaculturists, etc. And we explored those questions. So we rolled these series of events that was only 2 years after the 2022 floods that devastated our region. So trauma was still very prevalent. And we were not sure at the beginning when we were designing the first one, whether, our region would be even ready for it. So we designed them in trauma-informed way. And we found out that, there was large amount of people who actually needed to make sense of that, not just prepare or recover, but also understand what do we do now? What does it mean to live now? Climate crisis is here to stay. It's a story of our lifetime. One of our guest speakers was Professor Clive Hamilton, professor of ethics, philosopher who helped us kind of think it through. And he was on stage. We organized it to be in conversation with one of our local comedian, Mandy Nolan. And she is extraordinary in helping people open up and be authentic. And that's what happened. We saw that happening on stage. And at the end of the interview or the conversation on stage, he essentially dropped this sentence, which I'm going to quote, and that really resonated with everyone. And what he said was, and I quote, "There is a difference between being fucked and being totally fucked." So that is the liminal space I've mentioned. This is where we work. Yes, it's fucked up. I mean, when you look at the science and the level of destruction of our biosphere, the pollution, the fragmentation of our societies, the tensions at global scales, and the different conflicts, affecting hundreds of thousands of people there, but also our communities here, it is fucked. Yet at the same time, I don't think we should give up just yet. There's an enormous amount of things we can do from practical perspective, from emotional perspective, from a social perspective. And this is what we want to encourage.
Yeah. And having done this program myself over all the 12 years or so, I really would love to see what it will be like if everybody tried, if every business leader said we can cut our emissions down, if every school said we're putting that course that you are offering in Mullumbimby High, we're going to put that in with our teenagers so they don't despair, so they don't get trapped online with ridiculous ideas, and get into the program, get involved, because it's the best thing for mental health anyway and survival. People have done that through centuries. Right. Get into survival mode, and we still wander around in the desert thinking somehow it'll just get better by magic. It really annoys me, and I'd love it if people got involved, because the longer I've been involved, I keep meeting people through interviews who are absolutely shining people. They're shining with what they're doing,
Agree.
I love that you mentioned Clive Hamilton, because he was the very first person I interviewed, and I did a hour with him on one of his books about the absolute end, and he quoted poetry and he quoted philosophy, and he was incredibly interesting, and I love it that he's still engaged with you. He's still coming to communities and giving his knowledge and his thoughts to you. He's a great treasure, that guy.
Every year, Wildlife Victoria receives tens of thousands of calls reporting sick, injured or orphaned wildlife. The biggest reason? Road accidents. If you're driving and hit a native animal or see an animal injured by the side of the road, call Wildlife Victoria's Emergency Response Service on 0384 007300, and remember to slow down, especially between dusk and dawn. Wildlife Victoria is a 3CR supporter.
But look, I want listeners will remember the Lismore floods and how the Courier Mail newspaper, we talked about that back then, and they became a real hub of keeping people safe. And I think it was because they were already organized. They already had their newspaper office and they were connected with the Indigenous community and they just knew who to call. And I don't know how they did it, but they kept people safe. And I think one of Plan C's project is setting up community radio systems. And as 3CR, we're very committed to that. All around the world, we train people to do that sort of thing in little local places. So tell us about that and how hubs can be created like that, which when the emergency does happen, you're ready.
To clarify, we do not seek to create a community radio systems, but what we do is we seek to create community resilience groups. And as part of that and helping people upskill, we provide radio training and emergency communications trainings, among other skills. So as a result of this, a number of our community carers and responders, or CCR, which is the name of this program, do get equipped with the skills and motivation to indeed establish radio communications network. So what a crew email did in 2022 was echoed throughout the region. We had a number of different kind of groups, including ourselves, spontaneously coming together and organizing donations, organizing volunteers, supporting people in needs in all sorts of ways, from organizing helicopter drops to transporting food through rope bridges made across rivers, which bridges had been destroyed by the floods, et cetera, et cetera. It was extraordinary, but it was very spontaneous, unplanned, and based on people's goodwill. So the CCR network, the Community Carers and Responders Network, is a network we had been working on prior to the flood, precisely in anticipation of that. And we really ramped it up after the floods. And we have since trained, I think, more than 500 people in New South Wales and Queensland. And essentially what happens is they undertake 5 days of training for us, with us, including 3 days. Everything is for free. Including 3 days of really focus on disaster resilience skills. So everything from understanding, hazards, like what do bushfires, flood, heat waves, etc., how do they manifest and how do they impact us? And if we understand the household, your street, your village, your neighborhood, but also food security, water security, communications, both the soft skills of it, like managing conflict, clarity in communication, conscious communication, and the hardwired, like what do we do if internet and phone, run out or break down, for 2 weeks? How else do we communicate, including radios, but not only? Mm-hmm. And then also power. How do we continue operating with power outages? So for 3 days, we focus on disaster resilience. Then we also focus on 1 day on psychological first aid and 1 day on practical first aid.
Wow. That's good. And they are prepared, because I think the communication is essential. If you've been a firefighter, you know how fires break out here, there. You don't kind of know where they go. And I did extra question, like, yes, what do professional disaster responders like that, like ambulance, like firefighters, what do they need to know ahead of time? For example, when a fire is on these multiple locations, how do communities need to improve the liaison with those? Because I saw in the floods, people were saving each other in tinnies and were disappointed and upset that the army didn't arrive quicker. But I think maybe the preparing stage could improve that.
Correct. And so there's so much to impact on your questions. Excellent.
Yes.
So in a nutshell, on the one hand, the army has made it very clear they do not want to respond to those sort of disasters.
No.
It's more of a political act from a federal government than an actual concrete. It's helpful, but helpful on the margin. That doesn't solve problems.
Yes.
What helps much greater is to be able to build not only the capacities, but also social connections of members of the community throughout the country. Now, imagine if all of us had a safety net. Yes, from the government and socials and support services, but also from neighbors and communities alike. And we could support each other. When you fall, I hold you. When I fall, you hold me. And we have this relationship of trust. One thing we often say is, we don't have to be best friends, but are we good neighbors?
Mm.
And that kind of underpins the philosophy. Having this connection, these exchanges, these kind of bonds, the trust that kind of emerges from that, then allow, in addition to skills and capacities and resources, to really build people's capacity to respond to disruption. So one of the, I think, problems we face as a nation, coming back to your question, is how do emergency services and institutions really communicate better and collaborate better with those emerging community resilience groups and members of community? There's like the Royal Commission, the 2020 Bushfire Royal Commission stated very clearly, and I nearly quoted from the top of my head, the emergency services do not and never will have the capacity to respond to every need, person in need in large scale accompanying disasters. In other words, there cannot be a fire truck in front of every house.
No.
We know this. There's no surprise. We should not be surprised by any other unprecedented disrupting disasters, because we know it's going to happen. So if we can build this capacity, those networks, the network of people who are connected, who are skilled, and then who can collaborate with emergency services, and there are really different ways of functioning. Like as a firefighter, it's very top-down, very old-school, established, constrained by liabilities. But as a member of community, it's very horizontal, fluid, organic. And so there are different cultures. And as a nation, we're kind of exploring that space of collaboration. How does it look like in practice? How can you build this trust, you know, while we come from such different perspectives? And we're making it up, you know, with more or less success.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I think is if everyone can be helpful, it's better than if some people are completely switched off. And I think a lot of people we worry about, like in the pandemic, some people just went off on another whole path of I'm not going to cooperate with this, and I'm not going to take orders from government, and, you know, made it themselves a liability to other people. But you're doing something in the high schools, which is I think organized by the students, called Surviving Disasters Program. And I think a lot of high schools around Australia would love that, because a lot of it is that sort of psychological first aid of how to help someone who's really switching off, can't bear it, can't face it, can't do anything, tuned into strange internet websites that tell them a lot of nonsense, and they're therefore not useful, not helpful. Tell us about that high school course.
Surviving Disaster is another project funded by Multicultural New South Wales that we have co-designed with young people, but essentially is similar content than what we deliver through the Community Cares and Responders Network. So not only it provides psychological first aid practices, but also look at very practical ways young people can express their opinions and their voice and be heard when it comes from an informed perspective, and have agency, knowing what to do. So voice and agency drive our project. And we do offer psychological first aid, but also very practical ways. Like one of our guest speaker at Facing Up, which I mentioned earlier, climate scientist, she said, you know, action is the antidote to despair. So how can we equip our young people with the skill that they can take leadership in their own community or family or school? To better prepare and respond, recover from disruptions. But also, we look into misinformation and disinformation. It's hugely problematic, as you mentioned, and especially in times of disaster, made worse. So we also, as part of Surviving Disaster, have learnings on this and helping the young people who undertake our courses to develop their critical thinking skills to not fall prey are such kind of activities.
Wow, that is terrific. That's helpful in general for life, I think.
Thank you.
But we started in Brazil, where Belém may become, I think, the Tower of Babel. And so many communities now know firsthand the drama of climate change and the disaster of not being prepared. And one of the United Nations' main agendas for this Belém conference is building resilience for cities and infrastructure and water. Where do you see the bright examples of climate resilience around the world in places where they've implemented something like what you're doing in Lismore?
Well, you know, in my previous career, when I was working in war zones, something that really surprised me, but I saw again and again and again, was that even in places that are hugely destroyed, life continues. Because that's who we are as humans. We are driven to live and survive. And so we will do whatever it takes to do it. And I have seen in all sorts of different contexts, people coming together to support each other, to share resources, including food or water, to provide help, to nurture. It's just a human trait that we share. And so to me, resilience is always present in a way. We kind of haven't emphasized it lately, but it's who we are. It's part of our nature. Like, I could give you so many examples. I'm just conscious of the time, but some example of what I have seen is in the Congo. I worked in different refugee camps, and people were self-organizing to make sure that, you know, when you have 100,000 people in a crowded space, it doesn't turn into chaos. And it works. You know, yeah, it's not flowy necessarily, but it works. Another example is when I was working in Iraq, and I moved to Iraq. I lived there for a year and a half, and I moved there just at the fall of Saddam Hussein. It was chaotic, quite anarchic, and there was no order, essentially. And one example of that was people would drive on any side of the road, left, right, you know, whether they would totally not care at all about the lights or the signs, nothing. They would just do whatever, you know, they deemed was best for themselves. But after 3 weeks of that, there was such massive congestions that people start self-organizing and say, you know what, actually works better when we have rules. And they kind of collectively, you know, organically, but with people also taking the leadership, getting physically out of the car and starting regulating traffics, bring back some order, some flow into that. So these are some examples of resilience that I've witnessed. You know, it's a very human trait, which we can nurture and should nurture, but it's definitely in us.
Fantastic. Yes. Well, I'd like to thank you. We've been speaking to Dr. Jean Renouf, founder and chair of the board at Plan C. And listeners, please check out their website, Plan C. They've got a booklet there in French and English called Mutual Aid. And Jean is going to write a book soon, he's told me. And when that book comes out, I think that should show quite a bit of leadership. They're already proving it with people, but then you have to have thought leadership too. You have to have some, like Clive Hamilton, you have to write the books that give the thought leadership. So thank you very much for speaking to us. Thank you.
Great pleasure, Vivienne. Thank you.
Disasters like flood, fire, and extreme heat can have a significant impact on people's lives. Community legal centres help people experiencing challenges posed by climate change and disasters to access the resources and support they need. Disasters can lead to a range of problems, such as damage to your home, poor conditions with your rental home, difficulty getting insurance, issues within families, at work, and with Centrelink payments. Community legal centres can be found across Victoria and can provide help if you've been affected by a disaster. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres website at fclc.org.au. You can also contact Disaster Legal Help Victoria on 1800 113 432 and go to its website for helpful information at disasterlegalhelp.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Disaster Conversations is a new film which I think will be screened at the United Nations Climate Conference in Belém. Bernadette Trench-Tiedemann is with us to talk about how she had the idea of linking up people in Brazil and people in Australia at Fitzroy Crossing. So welcome, Bernadette. Thanks for talking to us today. Can you just sketch us for us the two disasters that link those two places?
When I was in the south of Brazil in Boisecanga, they had had the biggest rain event in Brazil's history. Recorded history at that stage, January 2023. And that rain had caused landslides and widespread flooding and had cut off a lot of the sort of small communities along the coastline there. And very tragically, in those landslides, particularly in one of those communities called Vila Saí, which is built up against a series of hills in the rainforest, tragically, 64 people lost their lives under those landslides, and they were buried and their houses were destroyed. A lot of houses were destroyed also damage, widespread damage across the coastline there. And then that was their wet season time as well, so they're used to getting a lot of rain, but that was beyond anything people had experienced in the past.
Yeah.
And so, yes, roads were cut off, and then the community really just had to pull together and, you know, try and rescue people basically from under the mud and, you know, underneath cars and underneath houses. And then the official government help kind of came sort of 36 hours after the event. And so in Fitzroy Crossing around the same time, they also had, well, ex-tropical cyclone Ellie at the time had been sort of circling around the top end there, like the north of the Kimberley and across into the NT for quite a while. And then it sort of just came to rest over the Fitzroy Valley and it just stayed there. And so the whole river system just filled up immensely and was at the time the sort of highest recorded levels of river height of the Fitzroy River or the Muddawarra. And so what happened is that, you know, there's usually flooding there every year in the wet season. So the wet seasons happen at the same time in the south of Brazil and in the Kimberley. And the river, you know, broke the banks. It broke the sort of main bridge that goes across, that connects the town, in fact, and is also the highway, the main highway that runs all the way, you know, from Darwin down to Perth. And it's where people, you know, get their food and everything. Yeah, also very sadly, it inundated a lot of people's houses and destroyed people's houses. And so because of that cyclone, a lot of the government assistance couldn't get into the Fitzroy Valley because they couldn't fly in. The helicopters and planes couldn't get in. So people were basically just rescuing each other with their boats and trying their best to, help each other.
It's very dramatic and people can't quite imagine it, but I think your film will show it. And I've seen a few still photos of that Brazilian, looks like a whole mountain's just sheared off. You know, great big mud down the side of a hill, and in the Fitzroy Crossing, there's one of the broken bridge. But a kangaroo sort of standing in the water, and a cow coming up behind it, and these two forlorn animals. Yeah. This massive surge of water. So the photos, images always get through, and you've just described it very well. But what made you think of connecting people? You got them talking. It's called Disaster Conversations. What made you connect people in both places?
Yeah, well, I was in Brazil for an artist residency. I didn't realize I was arriving in a place where that disaster had taken place. And then I realized because I saw the landslide scars on the mountains around me. So I met an ecologist. She was taking us for a walk through the rainforest and she also told us a little bit about it. Well, I asked her about it and I just sort of wondered, I was like, oh, I don't know if people are ready. Do people want to talk about this? Like it sounds so traumatic. And she was like, yeah, well, I think maybe some people are ready. And because the artist residency, we were sort of creating work that was about the human connection to the more than human world. For me, this was like a very immediate situation that spoke to our connection. Hearing particularly Arthur's story, the artist, the Brazilian artist, after hearing his story, I was like, oh, you've really got to talk to my friend Natalie in Fitzroy Crossing. I feel like you guys have a lot in common. And like I wasn't personally in Fitzroy Crossing when the floods happened. I was in Broome and there was damage here as well. But yeah, there was Natalie's a friend of mine. So I was sort of just hearing a lot about the experiences then. You know, that was the initial idea. It was just like, oh my gosh, you guys just really have to talk. They're both artists. They both use a lot of different mediums, but they both love photography. And I was like, yeah, you guys could be good friends, maybe.
Well, I think it's a great idea. And we'll be talking to Natalie later. So we won't, you know, I'll ask her more specifically about her experience and about the conversations. But your film will have a big audience at COP30 in Brazil. And I think you told me it will be, maybe it's introduced by Professor Ann Poelina.
No. So we have applied to screen the film at COP. They have still not confirmed their schedule for the COP. This is the Australian Pavilion. No, that's what I was saying. We don't know yet. It's not confirmed. And Anne is also, she's going there. She's also got a number of projects she's going to be talking about that are, so Anne Polina is a Nigina elder from the Fitzroy Valley. She will be talking about a number of amazing projects that she's working on, and then potentially the film, you know, like that is a possibility. The COP itself is in Belém. I know people from Belém, and the impact it's having on that city is pretty horrendous. It's actually displacing a lot of like socially disadvantaged people who live in favelas. It's having, you know, extreme effects on housing for a lot of people, not just housing, but infrastructure. And so there are actually a lot of issues that are in our documentary in terms of the people that, you know, have the least and are the least responsible for climate change are the ones that feel the impacts first and worst.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's kind of being replicated in some ways. I'm not saying it's all negative, but by that process of having the COP in Belém.
Yeah. Just bring you back to your film may be shown there. And if it is shown, what do you think people will find that they have in common? Like for people from all around the world, what will they find that they have in common in disaster conversations about, especially about emergency response? You mentioned Fitzroy Crossing, people helping each other. Lismore floods here in New South Wales, we had same story. But is that a common theme, do you think, people will find? Or what other things do you think?
Yeah, so I feel like so far, because we've actually had a we've had talks with people from Lismore and Mallacoota through this community congress, which is all disaster survivors from around the continent, known as Australia. And everybody talks about the fact that if it's not for the community responding, then the situation is very dire. And that because often the disaster response is not led by community, this causes immense problems. And this is something that most people that we have spoken to so far are highlighting, is that the people in those communities need to be listened to, and they need to be, you know, they need to be at leading that response to disasters, and particularly a lot of them are, you know, climate change related.
And if we listen to the people, you know, the commonality of experience in all these different, very specific locations, but if it's fire or flood, it's different type of emergency, but the coming out of that, what do those communities most need? I also attended that conference and Congress, and it was hard to kind of get a thread, but mainly the message came through to me that no one's coming to save you. People learn that, but it's not good enough, because climate change is going to bring this kind of stuff on so many communities so many times. We can't go on just with that idea. What do you think is important to learn?
Well, I think I'm an artist. My life is not just, unfortunately, and like I'm not a researcher on disaster response. However, a lot of the testimonies I've heard from people on the ground is that firstly, there needs to be action on the climate change, what is causing these disasters. And there needs to be an investment in, you know, making sure people are in, you know, have safe places to live, are in like where there's funding put into building resilience in all of these places, particularly vulnerable places. And that is, there's definitely more money put into disaster response, unfortunately, than, well, which is has to happen. But like that, the focus also needs to be on preventing and mitigating the effects of it and the impact of it.
Yeah, well, I know you're an artist, and I've seen some of your work on the website, and you did one for coronavirus. And I think a lot of art, you know, we need that in an emergency like that particular one. People need to visualize what the threat is and what the response needs to be. And you did that beautifully there, very with your animation. I think similarly with climate change, it's a lot too big for people to take in. I think over all the years I've been doing these interviews, I find people, they can only get their local experience of it. But in the Brazilian government, they've got someone I find very impressive. She's called Sonia Guajajara.
Yes.
She's the Minister of Indigenous Affairs, and she's promoting strengthening Indigenous territories. And of course, they've been threatened by logging and mining and all kind of predatory stuff going on for years. But Lula is a president who's promising, you know, zero deforestation by 2030. Make these promises. I know we can't just take them for the paper they're written on, but still, she's promoting this thing about indigenous territories. Professor Anne Pauline
Absolutely.
Is going to be there. She's promoting something similarly around the Kimberley, very practical things. What do you think about First Nations? It's hard for us to put them first at the centre. And also you mentioned the more than human world. It's hard for us to put that at the centre of our climate mitigation efforts.
I feel like slowly the tables are turning in terms of who has power and who has the voice that is heard. And Aunty Anne Paulina is like one of many examples of people who are just like taking that power back. And speaking to the people that are currently in power and demanding what is needed and demanding that people on the ground, First Nations people, are leading that and that they're listened to. And I mean, this applies to so many different issues. It is often, unfortunately, the people who have the least resources and who are in the most vulnerable situations, socially, financially, are the ones who are getting impacted the most, and their voices are also becoming louder and stronger. It's one of those cases where the people in power, they don't want to give that power to anyone, so you've actually got to take it. I think like the civil rights movements all over the world have proven that a number of times over. Yeah, you only have to look at things like situations like Hurricane Katrina and what happened there, that people like just have to realize that they have to organize amongst themselves as well. They have to have that community resilience and know their neighbors and have those networks in place in order to deal with these situations where they are left high and dry by the official channels, by the official government agencies. That's my perspective on it.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to, we'll be talking to Natalie later, but please tell listeners in Sydney and Melbourne if or where they can see your film, Disaster Conversations.
Ben is a number of different disaster-affected communities. People from disaster-affected communities have contacted us because they want to screen the film within their community, and this is a really important part of our, I guess, strategy, is that we really want to encourage that solidarity between people.
Thank you very much. And when it has got a release somewhere in the cities, let me know and I'll advertise it on the radio. But otherwise, people can contact you if they want to show the screen.
Thanks
We've been
so
talking,
much,
talking to an artist in Broome, and she's been to Brazil and she's connected Brazil with Fitzroy Crossing. And I just want you all to see the film because I've only seen a tiny bit of it at the conference, but really it does look really very profound. So thank you very much, Bernadette.
Thanks so much, Vivian. Lovely to speak to you.
This is Stephen Pigram from up Broome way, Yawuru country, and it's great to be down in Melbourne and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio. Been here for a long time. Where I belong.
Natalie Davey co-produced the film Disaster Conversations, and I want to hear about what she had in common with the artist in Brazil, and so what we can learn about being prepared as a community. But she's also a broadcaster and won the Community Broadcasting Prize for Excellence in Indigenous Broadcasting. So can we start with that, Natalie? Tell us about your morning show at Wonky Radio, especially talking to your community about the wet season, the pandemic, and all of the disasters that, you know, people want to know about.
So Wonky Radio is our local radio station and our program is me and my father who are the host of it. However, my mother is in, you know, the background with a lot of the research and stuff, and it's quite a family, like a production, I guess you'd call it. So my father is a Wurundjeri teacher, so it's sort of the perfect, and he's also very entertaining, has lots of dad jokes.
I heard about it.
We have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
He he's very insane, and people have been telling us for years that he needs to be on radio. And there's been a couple of attempts, but then when I said, "Oh well," I was just thinking, I would join him just for a little bit so he got used to radio, and then he could do it. But we started in 2020, and we're still going. So yeah, but
He's never going to let you go. He won't let you go.
no, I mean, the name, it means two of us, and it has meant two of us, even with the name change. And we just focus on all the different things that are happening with, literally outside the window as we're talking. Sometimes we go through all the different types of rain or all the different types of cloud, and the language associated with it, but also all the stories around that season or what's going on. So it's always about what's happening on the ground when we create our shows. So it kind of works perfectly for doing things like emergency broadcasting. So I mean, he started in the COVID in COVID times, and that was because the person who had the morning show had to go back out, headed back out to their community during that time. And both my dad and I were a part of a town. Our communities were considered a part of town, so we were allowed to access our work. And we both worked at the early childhood center, and at that point that was considered essential services. So we were both allowed to continue coming back in. And then I went to inquire because it was so quiet about the radio, and they're like, "Oh yeah, well, you can come in tomorrow." And I was like, "No." And so that was a Tuesday. We went in on a Wednesday and started in April, and then we just kept going. So we did a lot of COVID messaging, and we got a lot of, like, because Dad used to do interpreting, where the translating of health messages and different things into other languages. So I mean, we started with that kind of emergency broadcasting right at the beginning of it. So we kind of had that kind of stuff under our belts by the time we hit the flood. All the information that came out as we went,
And how did you
it
go in the
was a
flood?
bit of emergency broadcasting.
How did you go in the
Oh,
flood?
it depends on if you're talking broadcasting. It was awesome when we got evacuated in, and I found Dad, and we could start back with our word of the day, because that was just so much fun. And I think our first word of the day was because the water had turned and started retreating. So our word of the day, I can't remember now, but it meant flowing backwards. And we just sort of, all of our words of the day related to things that were happening to the flood. And we did a whole thing on stomach feelings. Said, look, if people are going to be angst and just being aware of, your feelings throughout it. We just, everything was associated with what we were hitting, what we were feeling and going through, because we both had to evacuate our homes, and we were kind of just wandering the streets of Fitzroy. You were very much updated with, everything that was happening as you were standing in line at the food bank, helping, move things around. So there was one part of it where, because Wongi wasn't affected by the flood, like the water hadn't come up to it or anything, just to have some normalcy in all of this chaos outside, like the entire community is just changed forever. Everybody's in very basic survival mode. And to have some fun and some entertainment back on radio, it was a bit of a haven, but it also was quite a stressor, because we were trying to get information, which was like pulling teeth from DFIS. And well, I must give credit to DFIS, is they did, out of all the outside services, they were very good at working through and working on that communication. Yes, it was extremely difficult, and there's a lot of processes that could be fixed, but it still was a big effort, and for us to just get basic information to be able to broadcast. And I was in touch with my friend from the with of Australian Indigenous interpreting WA, or Australian interpreting WA, AOR, who basically, I was like, these are the messages that we're getting in. So they set up meetings with DFIS in Perth to get the messaging. Then we were able to play it in all the other languages, mainly Creole, because that's sort of the most Kimberley Creole, which is the most sort of widespread language, I guess, around here.
Oh, I think it's terrific. You know, I visited East Timor quite a few years ago when it was free, you know, and I met a broadcaster there called Senora Dulce, and it was way up in the mountains. And she said to me they were often cut off by landslides, by and the roads are terrible anyway, but mud and rivers, you know. And so she did this radio program, and she was trained by Radio 3CR, which is where I broadcast from.
Yeah.
She was trained by them, but she just operated this very small, it was in a tin shed sort of thing, built the radio station. And she, I said, well, what do you talk to the listeners about? She said, oh, it's a talkback radio, but it's often farmers, and they ring in and they talk. They want to talk about their cows, you know, if their cow is sick, they want to talk about that. And someone else rings in and tells what they should do about their cow. And I thought, oh, that is such a good use of radio, because they're really isolated. Yeah. No one can come to help them. And at that DisasterWise conference, this was a conference that Natalie was at, and I attended by Zoom. So many people, from bushfire survivors to floods to drought, a lot of different types of emergencies, but people more or less all came to the conclusion that no one's coming to save you, at least not quick enough and not with the right sort of help. I'm interested in that, because this is a climate action program, and using radio for climate action to keep a community, as you say, keep it sane, keep it all a bit okay, even in the middle of a disaster, but to tell where the resources are and all of that. What are your thoughts about that? Did you come to think that radio is very important?
Oh, extremely important in that, because it is, like in that conference that we attended, it was such a beautiful thing of everybody coming together. And like you said about the mob sharing knowledge about cows, it's the people on the ground, and a really amazing resource in, you know, real time, with everybody who knows the landscape, who knows what's happening in the places that, you know, can call in and give real-time updates on who's needing help, who is, you know, if a road has been cut off as, you know, people are evacuating. There's just, I think it's a fantastic way that you can get that real-time help and knowledge out there. So, you know, like you said, with the cows, I have had this issue, and someone like, oh, I've done that, this is what I did.
Yeah.
The same way in, I got most of my information through Facebook and message, texts with people in the community going, oh, you know, this is what's happening at the food bank, and we've had this issue, can you contact this person? And we just constantly channeling all of that information, and then we're like, oh yeah, now we're good, let everybody know that we're open at this time. So that's what we had to do through our own socials, through our radio, and we could, at least with radio, we could put in, you know, repeats and keep so everybody knew and trusted and wanted radio. Like, that was what everybody said in our first meeting with outside services, was, okay, well, can you channel it through Wongi, so we have that, which they didn't do very well. And I think that's a really lost opportunity, because, you know, these things are there if the infrastructure can be helped to be set up and get it running. It's just a vital real-time link into communities and where everybody's at.
Could I have to say, who didn't do it very well? Was this sort of outside services who came in?
Yeah, outside services.
Yeah.
Yeah, they, you know, it was requested by community that they channel the information as it came into us so we could put it up. But, and like, we were posting on our socials as well with all of the updates, the way we, and then as people wanted information, we worked out really easy ways for people to read it, because it was just so overwhelming. to go over that. And then that was adopted by outside services in their new social media stuff. And it's like, okay, we're all going through trauma, having so many different places to check in. It's really difficult to make sure everybody doesn't have time to be going, okay, well, we'll check Wongi, we'll check the GIFA site, we'll check the Shire site. It's like, hold on, we have enough to deal with. And to be able to just have one sort of place that people can go for information is really helpful, just, I mean, for your mental health.
What I think is, it sounds like you and your father as people, but even that state radio station, it's a trusted voice, it's a trusted place. Well, just to finish, let's come back to the film, The Disaster Conversations. Bernadette was in Brazil. She met people. She introduced one of them to you. And how did that help you? Because you were right in the trauma of having had your house inundated. I saw photos of Fitzroy crossing the river. It was just dreadful. It looked dreadful, really a
Yeah,
dreadful flood. So.
it was a really, really lovely. There's something like, if anybody goes through a traumatic experience, it's usually yourself. So I don't know, I'll use ex the example of like a car accident. So say if I was in a car accident and I'm in a hospital, I still have sort of family, or the hospital, and I have all of these different services that I can get support through. When it's your entire community, it's extremely overwhelming for everybody. Like, you are really supportive to each other, but you're also going through it. So to have someone who is outside of my space, but has complete and utter understanding of, like, different scenario and different place, all of those kind of things, but truly understands what it's like to go through that particular kind of disaster. It was just so comforting in that connection. And there was an ease with being able to talk to people. It was similar to when I was listening to people on the DisasterWise Congress. It was just so, I mean, you get triggered by all sorts of things about your own experiences, but they brilliance of having all of us together to be able to talk through those experiences, and it doesn't matter what stage you're at, it is quite a healing thing that we keep uniting and we keep telling those stories. So that's why, I mean, going back to disaster conversations is why I wanted to be involved, was to continue getting that story and that experience out there. And I think with doing so, we can create an amazing map of what works and what doesn't, and at least open this gate so these horses can get to higher ground. Like, there's just all of those kind of things, like that on ground knowledge. And I think as we keep sharing, that we can build a really good map to go look to our local, state, federal government. This is what is needed for people to, have a proper rescue and recovery and that whole healing process, because it's years.
Eventually, the message has got to get through. I mean, you are in a far away place from Melbourne and Sydney. The people who make the big programs are probably in Perth or in Brisbane, or but still, you've got all this. I'm talking to you, and I'm in Sydney, and we're just on Zoom. It's easy to communicate if only they try. So I think so, and good on you for the radio. That is so good. I love the thought of you and your father cheering everybody up and with funny and language, very comforting. It's comforting to have people talking to you just like the way that you understand. That's so good. But I have to say goodbye now.
Radio is one of my great loves now.
That's me too. Me too. Okay, so we've been speaking to Natalie Davey out at Fitzroy Crossing, and she's a radio broadcaster as well as a survivor of a terrible, terrible flood in the Fitzroy River. So thanks, Natalie. This show is called The Solace of Knowing What to Do. Thank you to our guests today, Dr. Jean Renouf from Plan C in Lismore, Bernadette Trench-Tiedemann in Broome. She co-produced the new film Disaster Conversations, and Natalie Davey, co-producer of that film and broadcaster at Wongee Radio in Fitzroy Crossing.
Thanks also to DisasterWise for their terrific community congress. Rising Tide is coming up in Newcastle at the end of November. Please register now if you are motivated to stand up against coal exports that are fueling climate disaster. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid.
Deep
Don't be
treasure.
Scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.